Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
If you have some skin issues going into the summer, join the club. We all do. Stay out of the sun if you can. I mean, big hats, wide-brimmed hats, under umbrellas. Don't spend a lot of time in the sun unless you're wearing protective clothing or SPF really high and good quality stuff. But after you're inside, you also want your skin to look good under makeup, or if you don't wear makeup. Men need better skincare. That's where my friends at Chamonix come in, who make the great Genucel line of products. I use them. I love them. Like, by the way, when I'm traveling, like my staff who's with me, they'll say, "Oh, you actually use this Genucel?" Because they're, you know, in my bathroom getting something. I'm like, "Yeah, I love it. It's awesome." The Genucel jawline treatment is a special formula with MDL technology. It's awesome. You'll love it. You put the jawline cream right along the chin line into your neck, and you're going to see the results. And right now, Genucel jawline treatment is actually free when you order the classic Genucel for under eye bags and puffiness. And with its instant effects, you see the results in the first 12 hours, guaranteed, or your money back. So just go to Genucel.com. That's Genucel.com, or text EYES1 to 77453. And for a limited time, Chamonix will include a second surprise luxury gift free. Again, EYES1 to 77453, or visit Genucel.com. That's Genucel.com.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Then on the fifth day of June 1944, just as you see them here, a fleet of more than 4,000 ships put out from England. This was D-Day, fourth anniversary of the Battle of Dunkirk, and the Allied armies were striking back. Vast squadrons of bombers and transports led the way. More than 11,000 planes spearheading the attack. Paratroopers landed in Normandy behind the coastal defenses. Landings made with timing and precision, perfected only through scores of rehearsals like this. Today, just as in these scenes, the armies of the United Nations have made their first landings on the soil of Western Europe. Another of the great decisive battles of world history has been joined. This is the day for which free people long have waited. This is D-Day.
You are listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. We're delighted you're with us, of course. 75th anniversary of the D-Day landing on June 6th, 1944. The world changed forever, and Allied forces began the assault that would beat back Nazi Germany and will thankfully change the course of human history. We are so absolutely thrilled to be interviewing the president on D-Day. We'll bring you more of that when we upload the audio, but I want to say that Tom Cotton, who is just one of the most dedicated patriots of in the U.S. Senate, he is a man of he's a humble man given his accomplishments, a phenomenal lawyer, served his country with honor and integrity in uniform. He has a fabulous new book called Sacred Duty: A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. And I thought of Senator Cotton because I actually was at Arlington on Memorial Day with my kids, and we spent quite a bit of time there, and it was very hot. And we went to the Arlington ceremony when Vice President Pence came and laid the wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and then spoke with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Acting Secretary of Defense. And just that whole day was very special to my family. And his book, I mean, it's just I had a chance to read most of his book before I actually went to Arlington that day. Been there many times, but it made it all come to life. And I'm just so happy he's with us. Such a historic week for the country, for our allies, for Europe, and for all free people. He joins us now. Senator Tom Cotton, congrats on the book, my friend.
Hey, Laura, thanks for having me on, and thanks for your interest in Sacred Duty. A very special day, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and I'm glad to hear that you were able to go to Arlington with the family. It's a special place for our families as well, and teaching the next generation of Americans, the kind of sacrifices that their ancestors have made so they could live in peace and freedom.
Of course, Senator, when you walk through Arlington, it's almost in a way too much to take. I mean, it's too much to take in for a young person. They can't really process what this is. None of us can, really, because every time we walk by a grave, I mean, and you stop and you pause, you think this was a father or a son or a wife or a nurse or a child. And I didn't realize that so many children were actually buried in Arlington Cemetery, children of the fallen.
Yes, unfortunately, especially in the older sections of the cemetery when infant mortality was so much higher, minor children were buried, and then their mother and father joined them later. So every headstone inside Arlington tells a story, and those are the stories of heroes, but they're also the stories of great tragedy and suffering as well.
Well, less than 1% of Americans will have served in uniform at this current time in which we're living. Is that concerning to you, that the numbers are so small and that the connection to the U.S. military from civilians has really grown in distance, certainly from the time that, I mean, even time when I was a kid? I mean, Memorial Day parades in Glastonbury, Connecticut, that was a really big deal. And I remember watching the World War I veterans marching and the World War II veterans and the Korean veterans, and it was a moment for all of us in our town to honor the military, and we still do honor the military, obviously, but somehow the connection seems much more distant, maybe because my father, who was in World War II, he's gone. The World War generation, two generation, is mostly passed away, dwindling in numbers, obviously, given the age. But I worry about that there's just not – it's not being taught in schools, really. And it's not really being taught in universities, except, you know, a lot of the negative stuff, or it's kind of a Wikipedia understanding of what our servicemen and women have done for us through the ages.
Yeah, well, Laura, I'm doing my small part. Every time I speak to a group of high schoolers or a group of college students and they ask me for advice about life, I say the first thing you should do is join the Army. So now, any of the services are great. Of course, I'm partial towards the Army, but there's no place where an 18-year-old or 22-year-old is going to learn more about himself and herself, learn responsibility and discipline, teamwork, focus, and leadership. I know that people at that age think they may fall behind their peers going to college or getting out and getting a fancy job. But trust me, when you're done with 3 or 4 years in the military, employers will look at you in a different way, and your fellow citizens will look at you in a different way. Now, to your broader point, you're right that very few Americans today serve. And when you look at a family basis, it's even smaller because of that 1%. Many of them are siblings or sons or daughters of service members. One thing I learned in the research for Sacred Duty, though, is that is not all that uncommon historically. It really wasn't until the post-World War II period leading into the Cold War that we maintain a large standing army. That's one reason why the Old Guard, as I say in Sacred Duty, yeah, is literally the Old Guard. It goes back to 1784, one of the few federal regiments that existed since our nation's founding. It was really only from the early 1940s until the mid-1970s that we had mass conscription, a draft where everyone served. So we're back historically to where we were. We still have larger numbers of troops under arms, but it's still an all-volunteer military. Yet also, I think the prestige and honor that we have for our young men and women in uniform today is probably as high as it's ever been. And as I say in Sacred Duty, there's no place that you can see that more clearly than when you go to Arlington and you see the respect and the reverence and even the love that our fellow Americans show for the young soldiers who are there and for those who went before them who are resting there.
Well, it's kind of our, in a way, I would say the last heroes in American society that with all the rancor and politics and the culture and all the changes to the traditional family and some self-imposed, some imposed in other ways, and changing mores and, you know, just challenges to the old military understanding. I think still to this day, men and women in uniform, they do elicit a respect that we don't have for many institutions left. I mean, we're tearing down statues. We're wanting to rename monuments, even named after our presidents. And I don't know. I'm fearful of that aspect of the desire to tear down history. And I hope the U.S. military never becomes falls victim to that.
I think one thing, as I said, while I was researching sacred duty, is I saw, you know, the shifts in public opinion towards support for a larger military versus smaller military. It's very common after major wars, going back to the Revolutionary War, that our military rapidly shrinks, usually by too much. But one consistent theme I've seen over the last 40 years in that research is growing support for our military, even at times when wars became unpopular. It was striking to me to look as a soldier myself in the middle part of the last decade, you know, when you saw the unpopularity of the war in Iraq, yet you didn't see the kind of repudiation of the young men and women who were fighting that war that we saw in the late 1960s and early 1970s for so many of our Vietnam veterans. And no matter our divisions, no matter our differences in politics today, I think that speaks well of our fellow citizens, that they have that respect and reverence for the young men and women who carry the burdens of keeping this country free and safe.
Senator Cotton, lots of other news, of course, we have to hit with you. What's happening at our border? I was down there about 4 weeks ago in Del Rio, Texas, and had a chance to interview a bunch of the migrants who we picked up with the Border Patrol boats. And all of them came with nothing except a piece of paper with their family member or friend or another illegal immigrant who had helped send money down to get them up there. And it was a shock to see it. I mean, Border Patrol stations were holding hundreds of people meant for 20. There was no space. They're overwhelmed. They have no beds to put people. The system of catch and release because of asylum policies. What is going to be done here in Congress, if anything?
Laura, it's a complete crisis. I don't think a lot of Americans who haven't been to the border realize how much things have changed just in the last year, because you have so many of these drug cartels that are profiting off trafficking people from Central America. Frankly, a lot of left-wing activist lawyers in America who are advocating for this as well. People are showing up on our border and no longer running away from the Border Patrol. They're running to the Border Patrol.
No, they ran to us. Yeah,
exactly. Because they know that they can game our system and make bogus claims of asylum and most likely get released into the country under their own recognizance. That's why so many Americans who do understand the situation are increasingly calling it a crisis. The president should pull out all the stops he has with every power he has under law and under the Constitution to secure our border. Because right now we are just being overwhelmed. But in some cases, as many as 3,000 or 4,000 illegal migrants every single day. And I think in the Congress, rather than trying to address longer-term immigration problems, which are very important, and I've got legislation to change some of those long-term problems, we need to deal with the crisis at hand. There are some very simple and targeted fixes that would tighten up our asylum laws to make sure that people can't show up at our borders and make a fraudulent claim of asylum just because they want to come to this country and live a better life and make more money. Look, I understand why they would do that. I don't understand why we would allow that. And if that's the standard for asylum, we'll have to grant asylum to 6.5 billion people around the world.
Right. Well, it's interesting when you talk to people, and they were mostly men, but most of them had children or people who they said were their children. A lot of them aren't their children. And they basically all just said, we're coming here to work. I mean, they all just said, we're coming here to work. And I mean, I don't know if they hadn't remembered the script they were given to say, or they didn't. I wasn't a Border Patrol official, but they all knew where they were going. They're going to Maryland, Texas, they're going to Houston, L.A., Boston, Northern Virginia, of course, Maryland, of course. But they know exactly where they were going. I mean, it was really disturbing on so many levels because we are funding the cartels by allowing our policy to continue. We're giving money to the cartels.
It's a complete farce, Laura. They probably were candid with you because you weren't wearing a Border Patrol uniform with an American flag on it. But as soon as they see one of those officers and they immediately say, I've got a credible fear of persecution, And they've, you know, been coached by a lot of these left-wing activists on what to say exactly that. But the truth is what they told you. They are showing up with kids on the border because the word is out in Central America. If you show up with a kid, you almost certainly will get released in the country. And then they're going to go stay with their family and friends in Arkansas or Baltimore or Boston or Chicago or where have you, and just start working and never show up again. It's a crazy system, and it's one that we can't allow to continue.
We're talking to Senator Tom Cotton, whose fabulous new book, Sacred Duty, just out a couple weeks ago, and it's fantastic. Senator Cotton, before we let you go, the disturbing developments to circumscribe speech in big social media companies, which conservatives have been talking about for some time, I just like your thoughts on that. I'm not saying there's any governmental fix here, but you see this as we get closer and closer to the real, you know, heating up of the 2020 campaign with quote hate being described as people who like believe in border enforcement in some cases. There are, you know, true hateful, racist, awful people. But then there are people who just believe the border should be enforced and concern, of course, that they're getting whipped up into these censorious acts on the part of Facebook, et cetera.
Yeah, it's very worrisome, Laura, that all these big tech companies that control so much of the platforms for public debate now are apparently full of liberals at the highest reaches and are willing to relabel just, you know, normal, ordinary beliefs of mainstream Americans as hate speech to be censored without even telling them that. I think it's very important that, you know, people in elected office like me or public figures like you call that kind of behavior out whenever we see it. You know, you said there may not be a legal response to it, but there may be a legal response to it as well. The law evolves and times change as our ways change. And these companies should feel that they're immune from any kind of legislation or other administrative action under current laws if they're going to hold themselves out as these open public platforms with publicly disclosed terms of service, but then begin to discriminate against the viewpoints of pretty ordinary, mainstream, normal Americans.
Well, it seems like there's all the efforts are underway to... Well, if you can't argue the economy, assuming the economy still is in pretty good shape in 2020, then you have to just circumscribe speech. You have to deplatform people, and you have to maybe change the Electoral College, which is the other effort. That's actually a very serious effort. They have a lot of states signed on to this idea that the electors don't have to actually vote for the winner in the state in which they are electors. I know as a lawyer and as a constitutional thinker such as you are, you must have thoughts on the Electoral College abolishment movement, which is picking up some steam.
Well, so much of what the left in America today is doing is rather than trying to change their message, change their appeal to voters since they lost the last election, is change the rules of voting. They want to end the Electoral College through what is probably an unconstitutional voter state compact, because Congress has not, and I'm sure will not, bless that compact. They want to pack the Supreme Courts. They want to turn Washington, D.C. into a state so they can have two permanent Democratic senators. Rather than trying to upend all these longstanding institutions that our democracy has, maybe they could just change their pitch so they can get a few more people in Wisconsin to vote for them.
Tom Cotton, the book Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. It's beautifully written, and just a reminder once again of how important service to one's country is. And if you have a chance to serve your country, you'll never regret it, as Senator Cotton said. And we realize how hot those uniforms are when we read this book and the sweat that I saw pouring down the faces of these poor soldiers at Arlington. Oh, my gosh. A number of them passed out, by the way, Senator Cotton. I forgot to tell you that. And they tried. And isn't it a rule that the other ones can't help them up or something when they're...
So it is pretty hot in those heavy wool uniforms in the summer, as I say, in Sacred Duty. The soldier to your right or left should happen to fall out of formation, then no, you don't break ceremonial composure. There are other soldiers who are usually nearby, hiding behind a tree or a bush, who are ready to step in and take their place.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was like, oh my gosh, someone give him some water. But there were two or three of them that just completely passed out. God bless them. Anyway, thank you, Senator Cotton. We really appreciate it. Congrats on the book.
Thank you, Laura.
All right. We'll take a break here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. But before we do, I want to remind you of all of our great sponsors, including the Delta Rescue folks. You know, I love my dogs. I love animals. I do what I can to contribute to groups that really protect their well-being. And they all deserve a life of love and dignity. And animals that are abandoned in the wilderness, well, where are they going? What is there anyone to care for them? Well, Delta Rescue is the largest no-kill, care-for-life animal sanctuary of its kind in the world. It's a super sanctuary home to more than 1,500 animals that have all been abandoned in the wilderness. And you can keep this beautiful mountaintop ranch to continue its mission of compassion by including Delta Rescue in your estate plans. 100% of your donations will go directly to the animals of the Delta Rescue Super Sanctuary. Look, you can't take it with you, so why not give a long-lasting, life-saving gift that will benefit our furry angels for years to come? For more information on Delta Rescue's tax-saving estate planning options, visit deltarescue.org/Laura. That's deltarescue.org/Laura.
I've been here a number of times, but it does something to you every time you come. It isn't a thing where you get used to there. It still has a very meaningful feeling to me. I don't know where the words are to describe it, but when you think of all the friends you lost, and 2 days ago I was up at the cemetery and 8 of my friends that I lost that right here that day remained right here at the cemetery above the hill here. So I visited them, and again, each time you do that, you just you feel like you're with them again.
Let's go to Warren now in Tennessee. His dad was at D-Day. Warren, welcome.
Yeah, my dad, Lawrence Hughes from Arlington, Tennessee, was in the 101st Airborne and jumped on D-Day. He figured he was in one of the first 10 to 20 airplanes, and his mission was to take out some guns that were overlooking Utah Beach. And, of course, you know, when they landed, it was total confusion, and he finally got his unit together, and by the time they got to Utah Beach, the guns had already been abandoned by the Germans. But anyway, they finally got all together and, you know, finished their mission.
Thank you for that story. Look, think about every minute of every war and every moment of struggle, and think of how many stories were left untold. You know, a moment where you think you're going to be shot, where someone walks by you thinking you're dead. A moment where you hold your best friend in your arms and he tells you something that he never shared with anyone because he knew he was going to die. That feeling of fear and terror because you know you're landing in an area or walking into an area that's mined, that contains other hidden threats to your safety. And you see people all around you who are dead or injured or dying, and you can't, you to save your own life, you can't stop to help them. The eyes of someone who's dying, the pleas for help. I mean, these are images that the soldiers, the airmen, the Marines, they never forget. Never forget.
It was still dark, but then as we headed into the beach, all the ships and everything stopped firing, and it was one awesome sight. It was, like I said before, over 1,000 Fourth of Julys, and it was really something to see. I mean, the whole beach lit up, the whole ocean lit up with firing from guns and everything else. And I thought nothing of it. I mean, we're heading toward the beach until all of a sudden bullets were hitting on the side of the ship. And the water, and I looked into the well of the boat, and there was 35 soldiers in there, and I don't think there was an atheist in there, because every one of us was making a sign of the cross as we were going in. And I happened to look. I I looked to the right, and I seen a boat get hit. And then it's, I realized what we were going into. As I hit the beach, Wally Lawton lowered the ramp, and the soldiers started pouring out. And I seen them dropping. I seen them getting shot. I seen them, their faces blown off. God, it was an awful sight. It's a sight I'll never forget. It's been in my mind since. This is the first time I ever talked about it. I hope it's my last. As they were going off, there was one soldier there that didn't want to leave. I guess he froze. He seen what happened in front of him. And we were instructed not to take anybody back unless they were wounded or dead. As I lifted up my arm, tell him to get off, I was shot over here and it came out my back. And as he went over, I don't know whether he got hit or not, I backed the boat out. And as I backed the boat out, we were passing the second waves that were coming in and the third waves that were coming in. And all of a sudden, I started feeling faint. And one of my crew members took over the boat and we backed to the ship. And that was D-Day for me. An awful bloody sight.
So those are the words of Richard Fazio. Operating, of course, one of the famous boats that made that first wave, second wave, third wave possible. And the images, I mean, I can't even imagine it. I mean, we focus on D-Day. It's obviously one of the most critical battles in all of human history. But these feelings of the soldiers and those who are right on the front lines and the medics who are having to treat the wounded and those who have to inform the families of the dead, it never goes away. Never. Joining us now is Craig Shirley, extraordinary biographer of President Reagan and best-selling author, of course. We thought we'd get some reflections from him. His uncle was a World War II veteran, and Craig is a big supporter of our military as well. Craig, I get so it hits you in your core. Like, I get a lump in my throat every time I hear a man cry, anyway, period. It's something about a man crying that I just...
Yeah, how do you follow that?
No. And, you know, when I think about this, and I think about this generation, and most of them are gone now, and I think about the things that this generation, I include mine, the contemporary generations today complain about and whine about. And it's embarrassing, frankly.
It is embarrassing. There's no comparison whatsoever. You know, hearing him reminds me of some of the stories that I know about from friends I knew. Like, you know, you remember Lynn Nofsinger, who was a close aide to Ronald Reagan. He was on D-Day on June 6th. He was an Army Ranger. I was having lunch with him once, and I'd known for years that he, on his left hand, he only had three fingers. And I thought they'd been lost in a power tool accident. And I casually asked him, I said, "Lynn, what happened to your hand? Let me ask you, I've known you all these years, and I've always wondered, what happened to your hand?" And he just casually said, "Nazi shrapnel." As he was climbing the cliffs, Nazi shrapnel, a grenade went off and blew away two of his fingers on his left hand. Mm-hmm. Another friend of mine, Dick Snyder, who just passed away a couple years ago, was part of the only three-year class to out of West Point. They rushed him out to get him into the World War II, and he was flying close air support for the – he was flying P-47, close air support for the D-Day invasion. He was shot down and crashed in near a farm in Belgium. And he survived the crash, and a Belgian farmer knew he was an American flyer, so he hid him in his barn, and he was there for about a couple weeks until German patrols picked him up and put him into a POW camp, and he was there till the end of the war. But before he got picked up, he gave, as a sign of gratitude, he gave his silk parachute to the Belgian farmer. Flash forward 60 years later, his wife Mary comes across a story about a Belgian family that's getting ready for a wedding, and the bride is going to wear the wedding dress of a silk dress made from the silk of an American flyer. Mm. And every woman in that family for the past 60 years had worn that silk dress. And it turns out it was Dick's parachute, which he'd given to the Belgian farmer, whose wife then made it into a wedding dress, and it was worn by every woman in that family for 60 years for their wedding.
This is, oh my gosh.
I mean, it's that stuff of movies.
No.
And then my college professor, and Dick lived until, we just buried him a couple of years ago. He lived to be 92. My college professor, Tom O'Connor, I was kind of feeling blue one day after my father had passed away, and he said, "You don't know tragedy." Mm. He was in D-Day. He was in a foxhole with his best friend, and his best friend was lying face down through the night as the barrage and the bombs and everything is going off around him. He thought his best friend was just asleep or cowering or something like this. And the next morning, he turned his best friend over, and his best friend's face and chest were gone. Mm. So, you know, we have those type of stories which really bring it home, you know, to the reality of war, the awfulness, the awful necessity of war.
Yeah, and why war should truly be a last resort. I mean,
sure.
The idea of, like, well, we're going to go in and change this country, and we're going to change that country.
Or whatever.
I mean, that's
and there
just
was really no attempt to impose, except for Germany and Japan, but we didn't try to, as Colin Powell once said, is that all we usually ask for is when we liberate a country is some land to bury our dead. And that's what we asked for France. We liberated France and later all of Europe, but all we did was ask for some land to bury our dead.
I think that when we contemplate the current toxicity of American politics, and I'm on the front lines of it every day.
Yes.
When you contemplate the toxicity of American politics and the utter lack of a common belief in just foundational principles, it's a little disheartening, to say the least. And
sure.
I don't like to be a pessimistic person, but you think of the millions of people who volunteered at the prime of their life.
Yes.
Because it was the right thing to do for your country.
Yes.
And for our allies who were good. Our country was a good, honorable country with beautiful ideals that deserved to be defended, as did Britain's and France's and the rest of Europe. We believed in those foundational ideals. But now we have so many people who think those ideals are either phony or were cooked up by men that were all bad with no good. And you wonder if we could muster that type of turnout today, if needed.
It is needed. We don't have the various manifest destinies that have marked American history for 200 years. Nothing to unify us as the Revolution did, or the Civil War did, or World War II did, or the fight against communism, or the moon race. There's the opening up of the West. There's nothing that really unifies us as a nation anymore. So we have fallen into raucous discord. You know, right after. And one other story was my uncle Ellsworth Shirley. Right after December 7th, 1941, he wanted to sign up, but he was 17, and you need to be 18 to enlist. But you could enlist if you were 17 if you got your parents' permission. He got his parents' permission, went into the Navy, and was in the Pacific for 4 years until, on his 20th birthday in July of 1945. He was shot down and killed in the Pacific in what was then French Indochina on his 20th birthday. And then, of course, is that the bureaucracy of bringing the body home, because he was buried there in Southeast Asia in French Indochina for several years. Then he was reinterred in American military cemetery in India for a while. Then his body did not come home until 1947, 1948, And that happened not just to my uncle, but to thousands of families. And that, not to mention that, is that there's still something like 200,000 Americans who lost their lives in the high seas in the North Atlantic and the Pacific who are still officially listed as missing in action, but their parents never got a chance to say goodbye to these these sons who died on the high seas in these naval battles.
Yeah, Craig, I was talking to Tom Cotton earlier, who is such a terrific
wonderful
person,
man. Wonderful.
And just incredible patriot.
Yes,
he was in the old guard, one of the honor guards in the U.S. Army, and
right.
He wrote a book about it. It's just absolutely beautiful. Anyway, we were talking about this. And I mentioned to him that I was at Arlington Cemetery on Memorial Day with the kids, and we decided not to take the roadways because we realized all these graves in the middle,
yes.
That you never get to see or
yeah.
think about.
You need to walk among them,
right? So, and then I was like, is that disrespectful to walk among? And I don't think it is, right? You can walk inside
sure.
the cemetery, yeah. So I walked with the kids, and a few friends from college were with me. And we came upon Jeremiah Denton's grave.
God bless Jerry Denton.
Oh, my gosh.
America's longest-serving POW in the Vietnam War. He was the one who famously blinked the word torture when the North Vietnamese filmed him for a propaganda film.
Right.
And he blinked out the word. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But
No.
I knew Jerry Denton well. I worked together with him in the 84 Reagan campaign. He was just a terrific, terrific. Admiral Denton was just a marvelous man.
I mean, and my kids, and I tried to explain, I said he was a prisoner of war. He was among the bravest men who ever lived.
Yes.
And they tried to break him, and they broke many of his bones, and they whipped him on a almost daily basis, whipped
Starving.
Their backs. Yeah.
Put in these horrible cages where you just sweat for days on end.
Right. So anyway, we came upon him and then Matthew Ridgway and
it's a tour through history.
Oh my gosh.
Who needs to go to the movies when you can go to Arlington and actually experience the real live escapades of these great American heroes?
You know what some really wealthy person like Steven Spielberg, you know, he obviously did all the World War II films like Band of Brothers. It would be great if at Arlington they could create kind of a virtual reality tour where you can, as you walk by the graves, you can actually see the history of each of the, you can't do it with everybody, so 300 people, 1,000 people buried
right.
there, I think, but you could do it with a lot of them. Wouldn't
sure.
that be interesting?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. It would be a great idea, starting with the Civil War.
Right.
And, the Bull Run, Antietam, so many of the other battles of the Civil War, and then through, World War One, maybe on Flanders Field, pick that for a poem, too, mm-hmm. as part of this virtual reality, right
imagine,
up until Iraq and Afghanistan.
I mean, just imagine what a new generation could learn that they just simply don't learn.
No.
Which is, I mean, if a country doesn't preserve its history, at some point it ceases to become a country. And
David McCullough said that we are now in our second generation of historically illiterate Americans.
I'm going to play something for Craig because we all remember Reagan's 40th anniversary speech at Normandy. It was one of his finest. Let's listen.
What impelled you to put aside the instinct for self-preservation and risk your lives to take these cliffs? What inspired all the men of the armies that met here? We look at you and somehow we know the answer. It was faith and belief. It was loyalty and love. The men of Normandy had faith that what they were doing was right, faith that they fought for all humanity, faith that a just God would grant them mercy on this beachhead or on the next. It was the deep knowledge, and pray God we have not lost it, that there is a profound moral difference between the use of force for liberation and the use of force for conquest.
I know Craig can recite these in these speeches
the
by heart.
To Hawk.
Right.
These are the champions who saved the continent.
Mm-hmm.
You can't he summed it up so perfectly. And there was maybe it was the last war in which there was no moral ambiguity, Laura. You know, certainly was in Vietnam, and there was in the war against communism, and not so much in the Korean War. But nobody thought, nobody in America, nobody in the Allies thought the Nazis, the Axis powers, had a legitimate point of view, as they even did in the War on Terror, that the terrorists had a legitimate point of view. There was the Republican Party and the Democratic Party didn't disappear, but they did disengage the partisanship, at least for a time, after December 7th. They issued a joint statement, the chairman of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, saying they're going to cease political activities for the duration of the war. It didn't hold, but at least they intended it to do that, and it held for several years. The Republican National Committee on Capitol Hill was actually, for a time, turned into a hospital for returning wounded American GIs. There were so many displays of unity and courage. Victory gardens were not a myth; they really existed, and the Boy Scouts were used to distribute promotional posters to churches and stores and grocery stores and bars. You know, and it wasn't just loose lips saying ship, but it was, appeals to, to fund the fourth bond drive, the fifth bond drive, the sixth bond drive, Americans committed, truly all of America, everybody, went to war in World War II, not just the men on the front lines, they bore the brunt of it, but the civilians back home through rationing and donation and scrap drives and metal drives and paper drives. In every imaginable way, the entire country went to war and gladly did so. There was no. I wrote a book, as you know, about December 1941, after the 31 days after December 7th, and I've done a lot of research, and of course had a lot of family members who served in the military and were civil defense block captains. And my mother had a victory guard, and both my grandmothers were Rosie the Riveters. Both of them. But it was not unique. This is symptomatic of the country. One of my grandmothers tested machine guns in Syracuse, New York. The machine gun would come down the belt. She'd pick it up, fire it, set it back down. And the other grandmother, get this, she was a bomb inspector.
Wow, Craig, you've never told me this before. How cool.
All the things, the little things of meat rationing and butter rationing and milk rationing.
Sacrifice. It was sacrifice. Now we don't want to give up our Wi-Fi for a day.
No. And if we, get out our link to the internet, we break out into hives. We go into the fetal position. And I suppose in a way it's good that we enjoy these material blessings from the freedom and the free market, but we have to remember that we have these things because of the sacrifice of so many men and women who went before us.
I think that this is just one of those times. I mean, Craig, I remember so well Reagan's Normandy speech. I mean,
yes.
Like it was yesterday. I mean,
I know,
just,
me too.
It's actually terrifying how fast, 35 years went by.
Isn't it interesting is that really no president, Eisenhower went back, he issued a statement when he was president in 1944, but he didn't go back. And then at the 20-year anniversary, John Kennedy did not go, but at the 20-year anniversary, Walter Cronkite took a CBS coup and went back to D-Day with Eisenhower in 1964 and filmed a documentary with Eisenhower. But Nixon didn't go back. He was embroiled in Watergate, and no president, but presidents since Reagan have gone back, but we don't remember Barack Obama's speech or George Bush's speech or anybody else's speeches. We only remember Reagan's speech because it was not only the first, but it was the most important and the best.
Craig Shirley here on the Laura Ingram podcast. Craig, you're one of the greats. We really appreciate your voice today, as always, and come back soon, would you?
Oh, thank you, Laura. Yes, anytime you ask.
All right. Craig Shirley, if you haven't read his book, December 1941, Reagan Rising, I mean, everyone is a gem. You should just do yourself a favor. Over the summer, please just get a pile of great history books, read history. That's how we learn. That's how we improve. And that's how we ground ourselves in very chaotic times.
What impelled you to put aside the instinct for self-preservation and risk your lives to take these cliffs? What inspired all the men of the armies that met here? We look at you and somehow we know the answer. It was faith and belief. It was loyalty and love. The men of Normandy had faith that what they were doing was right, faith that they fought for all humanity, faith that a just God would grant them mercy on this beachhead or on the next. It was the deep knowledge, and pray God we have not lost it, that there is a profound moral difference between the use of force for liberation and the use of force for conquest.
This is one of the greatest speeches, I think, political speeches of all time. That was Ronald Reagan, the 40th anniversary of the D-Day invasion on the beaches of Normandy, in Normandy, France. Raymond Geddes Jr. He's a staff sergeant in G Company of the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, the 101st Airborne Division, on D-Day, June 6th, 1944. On this anniversary of D-Day, and he's with us now. Mr. Geddes, it's so great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us and for your sacrifice for this nation, sir.
I am your servant. What can I do for you?
I'm so delighted you're with us today, and you know your reflections on that day from the moment you marched out to the tarmac to board the planes as a member of the 101st Airborne Division. Take us back to your regimental commander, Colonel Howard Jumpy Johnson. Take us back to that day.
You asked the questions, and I'll answer them as best I can. I mean, he was a regimental commander, and he was going to win World War II all by himself. But, I'll answer any questions that you have.
He lined you all up as you walked out. He lined you all up, and I remember when we first talked to you, you said you remembered that he shook the hand of every single one of you and looked you in the eye before the mission began.
Yes, he did that, yeah.
And talk about the plane as you boarded the plane and what was going through your mind and
the
minds of your friends.
I would mention this for what it's worth. I had never been up in an airplane before I jumped out of one, so I had 14 jumps and one combat jumps, but never landed. So that's my, I guess that's something to remember. The Army was good for me because I went in as a kid, and when I came out, I was a man. But I'm not sure exactly what you want out of me, but I'll do the best I can.
Yeah, no problem. You were loaded down when you went in that plane with.
Yeah, you have seen pictures of these guys going aboard the plane. It's very true because I had the M1 rifle, the Musette bag, hand grenades, and all the other kind of stuff. And you just couldn't. You really needed somebody to help you in the plane.
Just because it was so heavy.
I don't know how. Pardon?
Everything was so heavy. You had the ammo belt, you had the two parachutes, four or five grenades, of course the M1, you got the in your bag, which was not, now all the bags are fairly lightweight, Mr. Geddes, but back then everything was that heavy canvas. I'm just watching the pictures, watching the old video reels of the men even trying to get on the planes. This is before the action begins, and you see it. You imagine what a struggle it was to once you land, to just move on the land, being that weighted down.
That's right. I'll just mention the flight. we took off at 11:30 for a two-hour flight into France. I have to say that I never saw, remember, it was dark and there were no pictures taken because it was dusk when we took off, which soon turned into night. And so I never saw, I saw a red light, and that's the only thing that I saw as we were flying over. And it was a very smooth flight as we went in, and it was hazy. And then the plane began to bounce around, and it sounded like hail on the plane, which, of course, turned out to be shrapnel. And then, as we were flying along, as I say, bouncing around, and I looked out the window, and somebody said, hey, those guys are going down. So another plane was on fire
near you. Yeah, and that plane was going down. And so at that point, you must have been like, we got to get the heck out of here.
I used words a little stronger than that, yes. But, you know, we wanted to get out, and then, you know, then I jumped. As it turned out, we were flying at 350 feet, which is quite low. So it was then I looked around and I landed, and I was all by myself. So what I had to do is I couldn't get out of the parachute, and I had a knife on my jump boot, and I reached down, and it was gone. I guess torn off when it was when I jumped. So I had a knife in a pocket on my jumpsuit, which I had to cut my way out of the chute. And there was nobody around. I jumped in a field, laying. Only thing there were cows. So I cut myself out, and then our recognition system was one click. What you did, you clicked it once, and the answer coming from somebody else was two clicks. So I clicked it once, no answer. I clicked it twice, and no answer. I clicked it the third time, no answer. And then I had my hand on the ring on the grenade. I was just about to show to throw it. And then, of course, I saw some helmets in the moonlight, and thank God they were American helmets. And I told them, I said, you know, I was just about to throw a hand grenade. And there was a lot of cussing and all that sort of stuff, but they didn't. They said they didn't hear me. So
the men from your company did you end up meeting up with that night?
Don't really remember. We found each other fairly fast. It was still dark as I moved through the brush and all that business. I stumbled over some bodies. Now whether they were Americans or Germans, I do not know, because of course we were trying to link up. I was in that group that included the division commander, and we were preparing to attack the town of Pouppeville, Pouppeville, which had been a German headquarters, but that was later on. Probably 15 or 20 minutes after we, maybe a half hour after we hooked up with.
So, in your first engagement with the Germans was how long after you landed that night on June 6th?
It was daylight then. Well, and what time, of course, because who's looking at the watch? My watch broke either on the jump or when I landed, so I didn't have. I was a communications man, and I had this GI watch, which, as I say, was broken. But to answer your question, it was daylight, and I was on the left side of the road, and Captain Krager, our regimental company commander, was on the right side, and he, as the curve in the road as we moved around, he saw him first and fired at him, and then, of course, they were all killed, and we moved on.
So you moved the you moved the Germans back into their headquarters where they were.
Yeah, there was some kind of a firefight there in this town, and it was there were Germans there, of course, which we captured, and we had them behind the barn. And
did you speak to? Did you speak? I'm sorry, Mr. Geddes. Did you speak to any of the Germans that you? No, you never spoke to them.
No. I mean, they were shoved into a barn on the property, but I did not speak them. The only thing that I do remember at the particular time, there was a house there, of course, adjoining or near the barn, mm-hmm. and there were some the decorations on the roof, some kind of balls. And there were German rifles laying around, so I picked up one and shot it, fired it, and, you know, aimed at one of the balls. And then, of course, as you can guess, all hell broke loose because there was shooting. And I remember the first sergeant chewing me out because they didn't know where this bullet was coming from.
Oh my goodness. I've got to say, your June 8th turned out to be your last day in combat.
Yeah, that is correct. I was moving through a field, and I was by myself, and I looked, and over to the right, about maybe 150 feet, there were two Germans, and one guy was taking care of the other guy, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and they made no effort to be offensive toward me, because if they had, of course, I'd have shot him, but they did not, and then I moved off, which was not really smart, because they could have shot me, but I don't know whether they were armed or not. The only other thing on June the 8th, as I say, I was walking along, and all of a sudden I found myself on the ground. Some kind of a shell had come in and hit me in the leg, which bled considerably. Then I got up, and I was okay, other than a little shook up. But there was a dead German laying nearby, and I took his watch. He was cooling down. He hadn't been dead very long, and I slipped it off his wrist because, as I say, my GI watch was not working. Pardon?
Mr. Geddes, I could talk to you for an hour, and thank you so much for joining us on this historic day. Raymond Geddes, Jr., Staff Sergeant, G Company, 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division, on D-Day. Sir, it's a great pleasure and a great privilege to have spent some time with you today. Thank you so much. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Remember, America, now and forever, honor those who have fallen in service to their country and all who serve our country. In uniform, our first responders, those who've suffered at home, men, women, children, relatives, friends. Fly your flag proudly, not just on Memorial Day, not just on the 4th of July. This is the best country in the face of the earth, and we have to strive every day to make it better and stronger. We'll do that together on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. See you next time.